Maine author Carolyn Shute and her epic new novel. Carolyn Shute burst onto the national scene more than 30 years ago with her novel, The Beans of Egypt, Maine. Since then, she has written six more books, founded a group called the Second Maine Militia, and led anti-corporation protests at the State House and elsewhere, all while living pretty much off the grid in western Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Shute's newest novel, The Recipe for Revolution, is out today. It is the third in a series of interrelated novels centering on a place called The Settlement that might be a commune or cult or simply a place for people to escape. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with Shute about her novel, her politics, and her place in American literature. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Carolyn Shute is the author of a number of best-selling books, including The Beans of Egypt, Maine. I'm thrilled to have her in the studio today on the day her new novel, The Recipe for Revolution, is released. Shute is the winner of a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Penn New England Award for Literary Excellence in Fiction. Thanks so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. And as always, we want to hear from you and the audience. Which of Carolyn Shute's books have you read? Which characters have resonated with you or not? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Carolyn Shute, thank you so much for joining us today. And let's talk about this political campaign. Your novel, The Recipe for Revolution, has come out in the midst of a presidential campaign, released on the day of the New Hampshire primary. I have to ask you, what do you make of this year's race?
First of all, I just wanted to mention, you know how to pronounce the word chocolate chip. That's how my name's pronounced.
Is it Chute?
Chute, like chipmunk. Oh, chocolate chip.
I've spent 30 years pronouncing your last name incorrectly. I'm sorry.
I have a brother that still mispronounces it. You get in the habit, I guess. But, yep. meanwhile, about the primaries.
Yeah, the presidential race. Are you following it? Do you?
A little.
What do you think?
It's a good theater. It's not ever going to fix anything, you know, just voting for the ones that they set out for us on the stage. The money people, I mean. It's not going to do anything for the big things like climate change or the struggles that people are going through right now, just to get by. All the young people have to live with their parents. I just got a letter this morning from a friend who, her daughter has just got her doctorate, and she thinks she's going to be living with her for a long time because she can't, you know, it's hard for people with doctorates even to get jobs.
Yeah. And this is who you write about, the people that the candidates are not necessarily talking about. Some are.
Yeah, talk is cheap.
Yeah. You garnered a lot of national headlines back in 1996, which was another presidential year, for the Second Maine Militia and your protests against corporate America, including one at the State House. Since that time, so much has happened. The Citizens United case, of course, 9/11, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm wondering, Carolyn, has your message changed? Have your concerns changed in that time?
No. Citizens United, it sort of was built on, you know, in 1886. The corporation got human rights before women, people of color, or people who didn't have a lot of property. That was then, but they had to like work on it a little bit through the years to make it, you know, really good. And that's what the Citizens United has done, is really given them human rights. But you figure they're way ahead of us, though, because they have so much more for resources. And little folks are not humans anymore.
When you were staging the protests in 1996, I'm wondering, and compared to today, has your audience changed? Do you think that there are more people receptive to your message?
Yes. We were just talking about that on the way in, how it seemed so alien to a lot of people. They kept saying, well, corporations, people, well, no, it's a piece of paper. It's a charter that it can be ripped up. It's not people. People work for one, just like people can work for a slave driver or, you know, or a small business or various things. People can also do where they own a business together, things like that. But no, a corporation is not people. And so nowadays people are all talking about those details, which makes me very happy because I'm getting old and tired. And you can't really raid the state house anymore. They've got all this security and so forth, so you can't get in there and raise hell anymore. You have to behave yourself. You can't be doing any kind of, noisy protesting or anything. They throw you out.
Well, the novel, The Recipe for Revolution, is a series of interconnected novels, and I understand that they started as one long manuscript. I'd love for you, if you will, to tell us the story. How did you approach this epic project, and how on earth did you write 2,600 pages in the first place?
Well, my mother used to say I was long-winded. And that's what it was.
That's an understatement.
And every time I work on a piece of work, it gets richer, hopefully. I take some out, I put some in. And it was, I had two books that I don't like because they were only two or three drafts. It really takes me about 100 drafts to work material and try to bring people to life. As soon as I've brought people to life, they begin to, well, they do the story themselves. I just sort of watch them and see what they do. I don't really write it. They do. But so the work is getting them to come to life. And that takes a lot of handling and work, at least 100 drafts.
So, and what I read, Carolyn, and tell me if this is not right, that you had written about 2,600 pages. Your editor eventually convinced you to break this out into more than one novel?
No. My editor did pass away before anything happened. My agent, Jane Gelfman, she said, Carolyn, people are going to forget you. You know, this has been setting. And I go, yeah, I just work it, but it stays long. And she said, did you ever think of doing a novel about just Mickey and Jane? They were two kids that were in the novel. And I said, it was almost instantly, I began to picture breaking the book up into these different characters and putting focus on different characters, even though the same thing was happening as it was going along. It just changed everything for me in being able to work it. And of course, as I worked the material, each book became 2,600 pages.
Oh my gosh.
in just the typewriter, double spaced or handwritten stuff, not as it would be in the book. In the book, it's shorter because it's smaller type and squeezed together. The lines are squeezed together.
Oh my gosh. It's interesting. I'm reading this over the past couple of weeks, and as people have been asking me, watching me carry the book around and asking me about it, I found that talking about your novel has been kind of like talking about the movie Parasite. And it, like, follow me, because obviously they're really different. One is a South Korean film, one is a Carolyn Chute novel, but both are really creative, really thought-provoking, but also hard to describe or characterize. And I'm going to put this on you. How would you describe your novel without giving it away?
Heavy to carry around. Right? You wouldn't want to read it in bed holding it over your face if you're real tired. Well, for me, you know, it was a little world to go into, and the characters are people that I care about. They became real to me, so I kind of like them, and I like all of them, especially the crow that talks, Shakespeare.
Especially the crow.
Yeah.
The man at the center of the book, Gordon, is St. Ange. Is that how you think of his name in your head?
I think in Paris they pronounce it different, but in Maine, I have a friend who grew up in Lewiston, and she said when they put those little slashes on and pronounce them in funny ways, they would all say it was snobby. So the Maine pronunciation would most likely be St. Ange.
St. Ange. Okay, so Gordon St. Ange, he might be a cult leader. He might be a hero. He might be a criminal, child molester. We learn that different people view him differently, this larger-than-life character, and I'm wondering, where did he come from? How did he enter your imagination, and how did he become your central character?
I can't remember, because I started this back in about 90, in the mid-90s, so it's been through over 100 drafts. I can't remember now. I tried different characters. I changed their height, their sex, there, whatever. I change them all around till something starts happening. And if they're just brushing their teeth, they need to be changed a little bit. They need, their personality needs to be more aggressive or a little more sweet or something, you know. And sometimes you wind up adding all those features in. As far as those different, what you just named off there, those different features, that is views by different people. You could have, three or four different news shows, probably two, really, the Republican, the Democrat one, describing any one politician, they're going to come up with a different, they're going to see it entirely differently. So it's all about reality.
And different perceptions of reality.
Yeah.
What strikes me when you said your book is heavy, and I know you are joking a little bit because it's large, but it's heavy, And there are things, there's like an undercurrent of maybe that something sinister might happen. But at the same time, I think that there's a layer of real kindness. And I think your kindness comes through in how you view your characters, even the most unlikable ones. Mm. Am I right? Do you feel kindly toward
everybody?
Yeah.
We're just planted here as little babies, and we're who we are. It doesn't, you know, and then we die and then we rot. I mean, I don't believe there's any choices in life. We're more, there was a guy who was talking about, well, there are all these animals and they do this and that, and somebody brought up the bug, grasshopper or something. He goes, oh, they're just reflex. We're reflex too. We have a lot of reflexes. And that's hard to blame anyone for their reflexes.
I want to talk about another one of the characters, a 7-year-old named Secret Agent Jane, or referred to as Secret Agent Jane, who takes in everything that's going on behind her heart-shaped glasses and writes things down. And it made me wonder, Carolyn, are you Secret Agent Jane?
Oh, no. No, first of all the characters are just made up, or I've handled them so much that they become different, even from the beginning. But I will say that when I was working, I'm trying to remember now when it was, it would have been in the 90s, I had my granddaughter over a whole lot, and she had temper tantrums, especially about food, and she's a very, very chatty, neat person, she is. But boy, she was a handful. Her name is Rose. So we even joked and called her the Thorn after a while because she was so difficult. My agent even sent me a book called The Difficult Child, right? She's grown up now. She's 30.
I bet she's not difficult anymore.
She might be. She might be, but it's good. It's good. She's an artist and works for a dentist and does different stuff. But yeah, she had some little sunglasses shaped like hearts, and I kind of got it from that. But the character's different. She took on a life of her own, and that I'm glad of, because if you're being rigid with them, they won't come to life, even if you think you're modeling them after someone that's not good. You're not letting them come to life. You're controlling them.
I was wondering that maybe it was you as a little girl. I'm wondering if you were the kind of child who took in everything and yeah. either wrote it down into a journal or never let it go.
Yeah, maybe a little, because Rose and I are both Geminis. She and I. Yeah, there's some stuff that might be. I think every character has a little something. You can't help but that happen when you're writing, to have every character have a little piece of you. Even the microorganisms, when they speak, I have a little section on microorganisms talking. They're our ancient relatives. We all have them in us. And I think, every one of the characters is related.
Well, in the studio with me right now is author Carolyn Chute. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have questions for her about one of her novels, about the Second Maine Militia, anything with our beloved Maine author, Carolyn Chute? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Nature Conservancy in Maine, applying science and innovation to land and water conservation for the benefit of nature and people. Visit nature.org/Maine. And Modern Pest Services, now featuring the Anti-CMEX Smart Pest Control System for your home. Learn more at modernpest.com.
New Hampshire is a key prize in the presidential primaries.
2020, this is no time for small ideas.
Let us show the world what America can become.
Which candidates will win enough support to stay in the race?
We're going to do this and we're going to win.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join us for live special coverage of the 2020 New Hampshire Democratic primary from NPR News.
And that's this evening at 8 here on Maine Public Radio. Valentine's Day is fast approaching, and that means that love is in the air. Our classical music team is now accepting dedications from you to create the ultimate Valentine's Day playlist. If you have a classical music piece that you would like to dedicate to someone special, send the name of the piece and your message to music@mainepublic.org by this Wednesday. That's tomorrow. Then be sure and tune in to Maine Public Classical on Valentine's Day as we share your music and dedications from 7 in the morning until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And once again this year, we'll be teaming up with our friends at Dean's Sweets to send 5 randomly chosen winners a box of fine Maine chocolates. Again, the address is music@mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, best-selling author Carolyn Chute is with me, and we're talking about her new novel, which is out today, called The Recipe for Revolution. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And on that Facebook page, we've also posted a link to the New York Times review of your novel, which is just out this morning. So we'll go first to Peter calling from North Berwick. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to say that one of my favorite quotes from an anonymous critical thinker of the past is, "War is that unusual situation where you find workers on the opposite sides of the same gun." And now I have another one, because in Carolyn's book, there's a critical thinker of the past who says, "The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose who steals the common from the goose." And I think that lends to the very heavy nature of this book.
Thank you, Peter. Carolyn?
Yeah. That was wonderful. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go to Beattie calling from Camden. Hi, Beattie. Go ahead.
Carolyn, I'm glad you're still trucking. I didn't know where you'd gone. I remember talking to you years ago. I think it was Peace and Justice Fair in Brewer, and you came with your some of your militia people and kind of horrified everybody. And I really wanted to work with you at that point. I thought, you know, parade, kind of going to Augusta, and had a lot of ideas. And then you, I think, I don't know, at one point you had a terrible car accident. It's like, oh, I didn't think that was going to happen. But I just wanted to tell you that since then we mounted a 2-3 year campaign which failed, which was called We the People. And it was to get a constitutional amendment to say that corporations are not people. Well, we weren't as well organized as we could have been, but we got a lot of signatures anyway. Had to give it up, but thinking of you doing that, and I'm glad you're out there writing.
Crash. You mean the car wreck?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and then as I've gotten older, we haven't done as much getting out there. I mean, I was even just doing some protests with people. But our Second Maine Militia meant a lot to me because we had a mixture of people. We had everybody there. It was, let's see, what were they? They were, there was Greens. There was Democrats. Not so many Democrats and Republicans as the more rebellious, you know, the people who were questioning that, but some socialists, there was some communists, there was libertarians, there was secessionists, there were all kinds of people, and they all got along pretty good because they all agreed that things seem to be, it seems to be this force out there that's... sometimes it's invisible because it's so big, the way the system works. And yeah, it was in We the People. I've heard your group before. It was doing good. I know about the organizing, though. If you want people to be able to have a say in things, the more they have a say, the more confusing it gets. I don't know the answer to that, but I know that organizing is usually a somewhat hierarchical, I know they may not want to use that word, but organizers who you know, kind of decide what the next step is, and they do a much better job. As you know, the unions were very organized. There was lately, I've been reading articles about what they, oh, well, the unions were corrupt. Yeah, well, humans are corrupt. big business is very corrupt. They go, well, the government and the business are different things. The government's corrupt, the business isn't. But the government and the business are both the same thing. You just check the lobbies of these places, like, you know, Washington, D.C. is, you know, they go, well, we got it legal so we can be corrupt legally. well, it's very... it's very, they are organized, but they're corrupt. So then we're disorganized and chaotic, but we're not corrupt. I don't know. It's I haven't figured it out yet myself.
Beattie, thanks so much for calling in. I'm going to go to an email from June. She writes, growing up in rural Maine, I discovered your early books, The Beans and Maybe Less Lauded, but my personal favorite, Letourneau's Used Auto Parts, on my mother's bookshelf almost 25 years ago now. And I was always blown away by how you see your characters. With so few words, I saw these people in your book so clearly. I can still remember to this day reading about Big Lucian's wife having lavender eyes and how all of his wives had beautiful eyes. The line stuck with me forever, among many others. I saw the people from your books at the local store and in my neighbors when I was 12 years old. As an avid reader all my life, I know how rare it is to really make people come alive on the page with all their beauty and faults. Thank you for the brave and beautiful writing over all these years. I grew up with you and still love to read anything you put out, June.
Wow. How nice. That's very sweet. I know, though, it doesn't come in 2 drafts or 3 drafts. It takes 100 drafts. And, you know, I think a lot of times people... they get anxious to get it out there. You know, I was in the beginning. I didn't understand really how much work it would be to make it so you could see the characters yourself and believe in them. But it does a lot of work. I went to the clinic. You know, I'm a poor person, so I go to the clinic. It's got a discount in our area. And the nurse said to me, "What are your hobbies?" And I said, "I don't have any. I don't really have time for hobbies." And besides, I'm kind of a workaholic. But she said, "Someone said you write. That's a hobby." Yeah, well, I think it's in a way, if you write the way I write, it's maybe more, it's kind of a little crazy. You know, I would sit there and work on this for 100 drafts. But I do because I love being with the people that come to life for me. And I'm a very introverted person. I feel, and poor, so I'm very deprived. And I think that's what it takes to really put yourself forward, you know, get into taking writing seriously, is to be deprived of what it is you're writing about. And I love to write about a lot of people. But at home, it's four dogs, four little Scotty dogs, and one husband, myself. So I don't get the big crowd I'd love to have.
Carolyn, I understand in the past you taught one of your dogs to growl at the word Reagan. Mm-hmm. Are any of your dogs trained with similar tricks anymore?
Well, I had one dog this morning. Her name is Mary, Scotty dog, right? And she saw me putting my bags together, and she started hanging her head and staggering around. This is what she does when I'm doing something she doesn't like. It's not a trick that I taught her. It's her thing. She looks like she's dying if you're doing something she doesn't like, and that's getting the bags together to go to Portland. Stay for 2 days. She wanted to go, but I knew you know, I couldn't have her here.
You could have. Oh, we'll have Kathy calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. Carolyn, in the year 2000, I bought your book, The Snowman, at a Camden bookstore, and you were there and autographed it for me. And I really enjoyed reading it. The story was provocative and stimulating. And I learned a while later that snowmen had been removed from the bookshelves. And I guess I'm wondering, did that really happen? And if it did, why?
Well, the other day, Michael and I were taking some files down from upstairs, and I was going through all my stuff, and I've had a little bit of health problems, and I thought, I'm just going to sit down and reread Snowman, right? That was one of the books that was only like three drafts. I woke up in the night at a house where I was house sitting. There was a fissure outside. I didn't know what it was. It was making this horrible noise. Right? It got me so worried because it kept coming around and making this awful noise, and then I was wide awake, and I actually took the notes for that entire book in that one night and then did a couple of drafts on it. Well, I'm looking at it the other day, and I'm going, oh, my poor editor, he did not like it, but he always let me explore. He was so good about it. And I can't ask for forgiveness now because he has passed away, but it has so much overwriting and underwriting. Now, that's my complaint. I like the story, but it has a lot of overwriting and areas of underwriting, not complex enough, right? It's kind of a thriller. But the reviewers went bananas. The characters, the story. My husband always loved Gunsmoke. And he always liked to talk about Gunsmoke. And it was a little bit like Gunsmoke. You know, they bring the wounded guy in and Doc works on him. It was sort of like that. And my husband loved the book. But it had a lot of politically incorrect stuff in it that feminist ladies didn't like, because it was a character who, you know, I was trying to get in through the character. And they also blamed things on it that wouldn't be blamed on other books. It was real weird. As far as taking them off the shelves, yeah, I think it was kind of killed. I think there's a word, privished. Something was weird. Something weird happened. But I think partly because a lot of people who were reading it to review it really hated it. And I actually hate it now, and I'd love to rewrite it. And I my papers are going to be going, whatever that is. My papers are a mess. There's mice nests in them and all kinds of stuff. But the University of New England has started with my stuff. I'm going to do several drafts till I die with my pen in my hand and let them take it. So it'll be on there in their archives, my revised, because no one would ever want to publish it. Especially now, I think it's gotten harder to publish a sort of thing from the view of view like that character.
Kathy, thank you for your question. And I have a question that is related to what you just said. This is an email from the author, Monica Wood. She said, a new book by Carolyn is cause for celebration. I would love to hear her talk about how the publishing business had changed between her, has changed between her first book and this one.
My friends are calling. This is my friend's calling. Pete, I have to confess, Pete's my friend, too. Pete's, I mean, like...
The first caller.
Yeah, he's more than a friend, even. He's family. But Monica's pretty close. excuse me. How has it changed? Well, Monica knows this person, too. Madison Smart Bell. Madison Smart Bell is a novelist. I think he's doing a little agent stuff right now. But I just talked with him the other night. He was at my agent's house in New York. And he said, think about all these people. And Monica and I were together at the Stone Coast. And we were both young whippersnappers. And he was, too. Madison had come in with George Garrett. And he's watched this stuff very closely, how it's went. It was that these writing conferences, the schools, the whole mentality of everybody can write a novel, everybody ought to do it, everybody get out there and write your story. Well, they took it to heart, and there's, like he said, thousands more writers than ever before. The publishers are shrinking. They're really shrunk down. There's hardly anything being published now compared to what there was, and yet there are that many more writers. So it's very, very competitive and difficult. I don't know what that means, whether they're going to rule out good literature to get things that are sellable, or if they, I don't know, I have these like little moments of fear where I think they might rule out good literature if it's not the right kind or something, but... Anyway, yeah, that's the difference I've seen, and I bet Monica may have noticed that. I mean, she and I are able to get, you know, Monica, you know, we get published, but what about other people who are younger, who are, you know, doing some of the same stuff we're doing? Will they get published? As a reader, that scares me, because I don't want to be having to go over an old War and Peace, you know, get out the old books and that'd be the only thing I can read because stuff doesn't get published anymore.
Yeah. I want to go to Elizabeth, who's calling from the road. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much for letting me call. Carolyn, it's an old friend, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Moore.
Elizabeth Cook.
Oh, Elizabeth Cook. Yes. Yes.
Anyway.
Two Elizabeths. So, yes.
Two Elizabeths. This is just so exciting, and I just love hearing you talk about your characters and how they, you find them. And because I've been working on a new one myself for a couple of years, and it's just so wonderful to hear your just honest appraisal of things and your look at the world. And I just thank you so much, and I can't wait to read your new book. And remember, you wrote a blurb on my first one.
Yes,
yes. You did.
When are you going to come see me again?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. Are you still in the same place?
I am. Are you?
I am not. So I'll get in touch with you.
Yeah.
And, oh, my gosh, the whole world is so lucky that you've completed this amazing work. You're wonderful. We love you.
Oh, thank you. I love you, too.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. And on that note, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for author Carolyn Chute. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lamy Wellahan Shoes, committed to reducing greenhouse gases at all their locations throughout Maine, because what's good for the environment is also good for business. And Downeast Institute, fostering innovation and economic opportunities through marine research and education. DowneastInstitute.org.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Melville Weston Fuller was born in Augusta on February 11, 1833. After graduating from Bowdoin College and Harvard Law School, he returned to his hometown in 1855 to practice law. The next year, he moved to Chicago, Illinois, to establish a law practice in the fast-growing frontier city. In 1888, Fuller accepted President Grover Cleveland's nomination to serve as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He served in that position until his death in 1910.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine.
Hello, I'm Philip Young. This week on World Affairs, why has the U.S. been supporting Ukraine in its war with Russia? We talk with John Herbst, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine under George W. Bush, Oksana Shovel, a professor of Ukrainian politics at Tufts University, and journalist Simon Ostrowski. He's been reporting in Ukraine for the PBS NewsHour.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Carolyn Chute is with me, and we are discussing her new novel, The Recipe for Revolution, out today, among other things. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Gregory. So what do you think about Trump?
He's a politician, and I don't think he's stupid. He's not nice, but he's not stupid. And there are a lot of people behind him.
An email question from Barb. What are the names of the books in this series that you're talking about? So I wasn't clear about that. Would you say that The School on Heart's Content Road and Treat Us Like Dogs and We Will Become Wolves and then your current book, these are the three that are interconnected, correct?
Yeah, I want to back up. I didn't mean the people behind him. Little people. We know that people voted for him, but I meant there's people behind the presidents. That, you know, that's back to that other question. Okay. Are they interconnected? School and Heart's Content Road, Treatise Like Dogs, and this one, yes, and there's one more, which I'm going to work on if I don't die of old age first.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to go to Claire calling from Anson. Hi, Claire. Go ahead.
Hi there. My name's Claire, as you heard, and I live in Anson. And Carolyn, you were friends with my stepfather, Rob Lee Wilson. He was a poet.
Yes.
He passed away a couple years ago. But he, when I moved to Maine, he was really excited, and he told me to write to you. And he was, I remember you sending us catnip in the mail every year for a while. And he introduced me to your work, and I just was so appreciative of that. And when I first moved to my place in Anson, I started reading your work, and it really inspired me. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I know if he were here right now, he'd be so excited to listen to you on the radio, and he'd probably say hi.
You still got cats?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Yes, Rob Lee. In fact, Rob Lee was at the Stone Coast with us, with Monica and me and a bunch of people. Those days was before it was an MFA program it was just so exciting, all the people together reading to each other. And I don't know, it was just awesome. And yeah, Rob Lee was there every year there for a while. He was central.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for calling. An email here from Josh Bodwell, who used to be head of the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. I'm curious how Carolyn's writing methods have changed since she first wrote Beans. How has she had to evolve her methods as her books have become more expansive? Other than establishing that you now do about 100 edits, Carolyn, are there any other ways in which you've changed? It doesn't sound like you've adopted a computer.
No. I want plumbing first. I really would like plumbing. 72 years old, you want plumbing, you know? But I don't know that I'll ever see that. But, right, so I consider computer rather superfluous from that perspective. I have a person who types for me. So she every time I do a draft, she types it over. I go over it again, mess it up. She types it over. She's wonderful. She's my neighbor, Sarah DeRoche. I mentioned her because I couldn't do anything without her. And her little grandson, Ollie, he helps. Otherwise, just the aging process, you kind of look at things in a bigger way. Maybe that's part of the problem. You see more, experience more, it gets bigger. Other than that, the more drafts. I guess that's all I could say. And I don't even do any typing now because they don't really make a good typewriter anymore.
We'll go to Brett, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Brett. You're on with Carolyn Chute.
Hey, Carolyn. It's nice to hear your voice again. I really enjoyed the comment from the first caller, Peter. Brings back fond memories. So the question I've got for you is kind of an open-ended one. And, of course, I continue to think about how we go about creating positive, authentic, meaningful, revolutionary change. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book, Recipe for Revolution. The question I've got for you, Carolyn, is how would you go about describing creating a forward-moving, positive, authentic, meaningful change from the top down or from the ground up?
Well, myself... meaningful change. Well, first, I don't know, the design of the human being and the design of life, it's going to change. I'm very cynical. At the same time, top down, I think it's got to be first and how that would happen, how people become educated and change of heart. Those people who are at the top have to have a change of heart because it's not that hard for them to come up with the information if they didn't put a wall up around themselves. But I think partly, too, it's addiction to power and all that stuff. Politicians, those politicians and all of them in Washington are obviously prancing around enjoying their power and their... deals that they're making all the time and their future job with the big company or whatever, all that stuff. The folks down below, I think a lot of it does have to do with a couple of things. One is getting the information. What stands between them sometimes is their party and the thinking that goes with it since they were very young. And then they get swept up by politicians' silly talk through media. Silly, I mean dangerous. And they also, I forgot what the other thought was, but it's big. Right. There are people, I think, it looks that way to me, there are egalitarians and there are people who are believe in hierarchy. They want it, right? I always feel like in my heart I'm an egalitarian, but I don't see with human beings they don't seem to do it. They seem to be hierarchical like the other chimpanzees. There are some people who really love hierarchy and they're called suck ups. And they're also they're at the top, so of course they like it, right? all this stuff, now I sound like one of my books now, it's kind of going all over the place, right? Because I'm looking at all this stuff. I love working with Pete and those guys about the idea of, you know, you got to try, you got to work on it. And that's that's my feeling. Even if I think, oh, what's his name there? Thomas Merton said something like, you've got to do it because it's the right thing, even if it turns out that you don't change anything or it makes things worse maybe sometimes. But you got to keep going and trying to make some good change because you got to do it because it's the right thing.
Brett, thank you for your call. We'll move to Kenneth, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kenneth. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Kenneth, the old whippersnapper, Rosen. Carolyn, I wanted to tell, I'm so glad you spoke of the heart because it is so heartening to hear your voice and listen to both your honesty and your cynicism and your humane generosity. Heartening. It's just, and plus the 100 revisions that you speak of. Yep, that's heartening too. And just wanted to let you know that I'm here and heard you, and congratulations. What can I say? Can you say something?
Kenneth Rosen was my teacher in college. We could do poetry one semester, and then the next semester was fiction. And the idea of 100 drafts is probably like what people do with poems a lot, too, because the words matter so much in the music of the words and in what they say. So I think I carried that along. He was such a colorful and passionate person. For me, that mattered for my work, is that's what it's all about. He really inspired me a lot. And that's him, the guy that was just on there.
Well, Kenneth, thank you very much for calling in. What a treat to have your teacher calling into Maine Calling today. Wow. We'll go to Belinda, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Belinda. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Carolyn. It's Belinda Gaynham.
I know. I thought Belinda from Bangor, that had to be you.
Is this a Carolyn's Friends All Call Day?
Oh, it's been so long, and you're ever, ever in my mind and my heart. I will never forget your fabulous corn chowder and the most incredible catnip ever grown in the state of Maine. And, you know, I wanted to say that Snowman, I remember when you were getting raked over the coals for Snowman, and it was bloody brilliant. And I see it as a precursor for exactly what is going on in the world, and especially this nation today. And you could write a dozen books about this political, you know, insanity, political things that aren't supposed to happen, things that don't happen. And it's all happening. So I just think that you are absolutely on it. I'm so glad you're still writing. I can't wait to read the last two recent books because I'm behind on my Carolyn reading. And I just want to thank you so much. Thank you for including me in your acknowledgments of Schoolhouse. It just opened my heart so much.
You're in the acknowledgments now, too, in this last one.
Oh, my God. Oh, Carolyn. I love you.
I love you, too.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad you're on the radio. It's so fabulous to hear your voice. And by golly, I'm going to be in touch again, okay?
Yeah, come see me again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Belinda, thank you so much for calling in today. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Larry in Portland, if you could be fairly quick, that would be great.
Yeah, I will. Thanks. First of all, I got to say hi to Ken Rosen because that was what my call was about. Carolyn and I had poetry workshop together at USM. She doesn't remember me. My nickname was Flash Allen. But I was always stunned by the stuff she brought in. And I just wanted to corroborate when I read Beans of Egypt, Maine. I wanted to corroborate how true, painfully true that was, especially where I grew up. I could have placed other people's names on those characters in Beans of Egypt, Maine. They would have all been, you know, basically true. So, Carolyn, I salute you, and I say hi to Ken Rosen, too. Take care. Thanks.
Wow. Flash.
I love that nickname. I don't remember him as Flash, just Larry. But isn't this awesome? You can say hi to other people who are listening, too. This is cool. You got to have this show more often.
Well, Carolyn Chute, thank you so much for joining us today. Her new novel, The Recipe for Revolution, is out today. It's review in the New York Times. You can find that on our Facebook page. And for those of you in the greater Portland area, Carolyn will be sitting down with Bill Rohrbach this evening at Space Gallery to talk about her new book. You can visit the Main Calling website or Facebook page for details. In 2014, Bill reviewed your book, Treat Us Like Dogs and We Will Become Wolves, and he wrote, Carolyn Chute is a James Joyce of the backcountry, a Proust of rural society, an original in every meaning of the word. Lucy Suchak ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.